welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm your host, Katie Halper.
And I'm Matt Taibbi.
And we're really excited to be talking to Will Menaker today, one of the hosts of Chapo Trap House.
It's going
to
be really funny.
Yeah.
And we're back, and the viewer can't see this, but we're on a clock now.
Yeah.
The dictum has come from, we love Useful Idiots, but just less of it.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is shorter Useful Idiots is what this is.
Yeah, so, less Useful Idiots.
You're right. So just to tie up some loose ends from a couple of shows ago, we talked about merch. And during the show, I ordered some Trump drinking straws because liberal paper straws suck. So we got them, and you're actually using one right now. So
we'll recycle it, though.
Yeah, we'll recycle it. So four food groups are only four stories in the universe. There's Republicans suck, Democrats suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that horrible? I guess we should start. Republicans suck this week. Jim Jordan wrote a letter, the Republican, to Elijah Cummings, to the House Oversight Committee, complaining basically. This is a classic example of how things spin out of control in the press. Basically, he wrote a letter to Elijah Cummings worrying that certain congressional lawmakers had traveled to Mexico. And basically, the implication was that people like Texas Congresswoman Veronica Escobar had traveled to Mexico and had given instructions to people down on the border as to how to evade U.S. Customs and border security. And so that he writes this letter, and part of the letter asks whether or not this Democratic congressional coalition was quote unquote coaching migrants to get past security. But within like 10 minutes, that story turned into tweets from people like Jenny Beth Martin, who's the co-founder of Tea Party Podcasts. And the tweet says, elected officials coaching migrants on how to exploit U.S. laws. In other words, you pose a question in a letter,
right,
but then like within a couple of iterations, it turns into a fact,
right,
that the Democrats went down there and they were coaching immigrants as to how to illegally immigrate.
It's like one step beyond, some say.
Some say, I've heard a couple people say.
Some say that it's a sour grapes book.
Some people say
it's just too violent. There's too much blood.
Some say, exactly. Yeah. Then next thing you know, a couple of news stories later, the some say is gone, and then it becomes a thing. And this is sort of how fake news starts. And, you know, as ridiculous as the immigration story was, this is a classically, shameless sort of right-wing
that'll
thing.
That'll get picked up, I'm sure.
Right, yeah, exactly. So there's that. What do we got for Democrats suck?
For Democrats suck, we get to return to one of my favorites, Neera Tanden. Turns out that the Think Progress website, which is the website for the think tank Center for American Progress, they shut down their website, and then they fired everyone, and then they relaunched. So that was interesting.
But why did they do that, Katie?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Right, yeah.
They hired scabs.
Buried the lead.
I'm sorry. I really buried the lead. You see, they're paying me. CAP is paying me. So on Friday, Navin Nayak, who's the executive director of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, announced the end of Think Progress as an independent enterprise focused on original reporting, citing the challenging trends in digital news media that have undermined so many iconic outlets, which he said made it unsustainable for a nonprofit like CAP to continue supplementing it. And according to the Daily Beast, Think Progress was looking at a $3 million deficit in 2019, due in part to a shortfall in advertising. However, many former Think Progress staff members accused CAP of lying about its reasons for shuttering the site, calling it a form of union busting intended to end editorial independence. Those criticisms only increased after the announcement Monday. Think Progress's statement on Twitter was heavily ratioed, with just 36 retweets, 93 likes, and more than 1,500 replies, the overwhelming number of them calling current Think Progress and CAP staff scabs. Okay. The Think Progress Union is part of the Writers Guild of America East, and they said, we were blindsided by the revelation that CAP intends to continue operating the Think Progress site with its own labor and use the Think Progress social media accounts to promote that work. Our editorially independent unionized labor powered the impactful journalism at Think Progress. To take away our independent voice and use the wide audience built by the Think Progress union staff is an affront to the Think Progress mission. So that's interesting for a couple of reasons. One is that for a while, people have been saying that CAP, Center for American Progress, which is run by Neera Tanden, who's a big friend of Hillary Clinton's and a big Bernie basher and a basher of lots of people, including you, including me.
Yeah, Neera Tanden, I feel like she's like the, in Young Frankenstein, you know how you hear a horse whinnying every time?
So that
for me, that Neera Tanden is like the person whose name on Twitter, like I hear the horse whinnying sound every time.
An interesting anecdote is that Faz Shakir, who was, I think, the executive editor of Think Progress, he now works for Sanders, there's a story about how he asked Hillary Clinton a question And at the end of that event, where he asked Hillary Clinton a question, Neera came over to him and like punched him in the chest.
She punched him in the chest?
Yeah.
Like really punched him or playfully punched him? Like,
I don't know. I think it was between the two. Because I don't think he was that amused. Like, I don't think it was a good, it wasn't like a, oh, she was like, why'd you ask her that?
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then, of course, the New York Times wrote this piece about her, and they quoted her mom. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Always a good source. Yeah, it was a good source, yeah.
We're going to be talking to Will Meneker from Chapo Trap House later, and this, to me, is a classic sort of, like, Democratic schism. This is the wing of the Democratic Party that is just, they blare on and on about how much the, you know, the way to political success is to support unions, and then they turn around and fire their unionized staff and replace them with scabs. Like, that's the plan.
Maybe they're showing, not telling.
Right, yeah, exactly.
They're really good, yeah.
For Isn't That Horrible, I feel like you could do a Fukushima story basically every week because it's so terrible, but the Japan's environment minister, Yoshiaki Harada, told a news briefing this week in Tokyo that they're running out of space to store the radiated water, so by 2022, they're going to have to just start putting it into the ocean. So I was wondering, what was the plan until then? Were they going to ask every citizen? Like, in other words, they don't have enough space to hold this poisonous water, radioactive water, on site. You know, so what was the plan? You know, I mean, were they going to just ask, you know, every person in Japan to like hold a
ladle
cupful
some
or something
of it?
Like that?
Yeah,
exactly. It's crazy.
Have some soup.
So then they just make this announcement. They're like, okay, well, we don't have a solution, so we're just going to put it in the ocean and just sort of work it out. So that's happening, which is great.
What could they do with it? I mean, obviously, scientists have thought of this, but they can't, like, put it into blocks of something?
I think they're just drawing a blank at this point. Like, we got nothing. That's basically what they're saying is, yeah, we tried. We don't have anything, so this is going to happen. And, you know, we've already seen, like, the, you know, wines bottled in California already have, like, heightened radiation levels. So, like, what's going to happen after this? It's
they need
terrible.
To get Elizabeth Warren in there. With a plan.
She'll have a plan. Yeah, exactly. So what's what do we have in this?
So Isn't That Weird is a very interesting story about a guy named Hitler Romano. I mean, sorry, a guy named Romano Hitler. Okay. Romano Lucas Hitler, who claims to be Hitler's last living relative, was convicted for sexually harassing a minor. So it was a 13-year-old girl. The father of this 13-year-old girl complained. He had put a garage up for sale, and Hitler answered the advert. But when he turned up, he didn't seem to have much interest in the garage, only on Ania, his daughter. He lured her to his flat with sweets, brought her clothes and plastic flowers, and even offered to marry her.
Clothes and plastic flowers?
Yeah.
Does that work?
Apparently.
Okay.
He said it was innocent. I wanted to spend free time with her. They were just harmless welcome kisses, which is like disgusting. So a judge found, though, that he had kissed the girl against her will on the neck and cheeks. But that's not even the weird part, okay? That's bad. That goes under Isn't That Horrible?
Right.
The weird part is this guy is probably lying about being related to Hitler. So, like, what makes you do that? Most people would try to hide their Hitler relationship, but he actually is creating it. He says that his parents settled in Slovakia after fleeing East Germany during its communist era. He was raised in a monastery and adopted into a Polish family. And he says that his father was the grandson of Adolf Hitler's father, Alois's younger brother. He says that it's been hard for him to get a job, and he said, it's my cross to bear. But, you know, he doesn't have to have the name Hitler. And this was really weird. They didn't even mention this. He has a bald head and a lion tattooed on his head.
A lion
tattoo.
Okay.
It's
wow.
Like he has a lion tattoo on his head. Also, apparently, if you go to his house, he has a photo of Hitler on the wall and Angela Merkel, which is nice. But also, lest you think he's like a German nationalist, he also has a picture of Osama bin Laden.
Bin Laden and Hitler on the walls?
Mm-hmm. And Merkel. Don't forget Merkel.
Can you imagine going for a job? My name is Romano Hitler, and look at my lion tattoo and my bald head.
And like, would you like to see some photos of my apartment where I have hanging a picture of Hitler, Merkel, and bin Laden?
And I have a record for sexually harassing a minor.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But I'm really good at data entry. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is kind of a little bit of a slow news week, but one thing that happened that we should talk about, just because it's incredibly funny, is the sort of ongoing. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the Brett Stevens fiasco with the bed bug, which like continued to be a thing. after that, where the New York Times columnist Brett Stevens freaked out because somebody on Twitter, in a tweet that was like viewed by or liked by 9 people, called him a bedbug. And so after that whole affair, there was a really funny column that was written on Slate by Ashley Feinberg, and it was called New York Times Columnist Versus the Haters. And the essence of this story, Ashley basically catalogs all the different instances of New York Times columnists writing long, sort of windy, pseudo-intellectual screeds against the sort of haters on the internet and all the terrible things that they're doing and how they have too much power now. She goes back and she goes through each and every one of them, and they're hilarious. I mean, Brett Stevens has a whole bunch of these. Like, he called Twitter the porn of politics, and this was way back in 2017, when he first promised to leave Twitter 26 months ago. And then Frank Bruni wrote one. It was called An Abomination, A Monster, That's Me. And that was about, you know, loonies on the internet who, the sort of subtext is that the only people who should have voices are New York Times columnists. And then Barry Weiss did one, and Stevens did another one. So after Ashley chronicles all of this and basically says New York Times columnists have been writing the same ridiculous, hypersensitive column for, you know, years and years and years, she puts that out there, and David Brooks writes basically like a literary masterpiece in the first person. That's like his attempt to do Notes from the Underground. But he does a column called And Now a Word from a Fanatic, Inside the Mind of an Internet Extremist. And the whole idea of the column is, it starts off, I am a sick man, I am a spiteful man, I'm an unattractive man, I believe my liver is diseased. So he's sort of picturing the Twitter hater who has a voice now and shouldn't. It's unbelievable. So the punchline is, after being sort of called out for doing this, they do it again. It was just hilarious.
Yeah, I wonder if he like saw it and subconsciously wanted to provide a really good example.
Right. Yeah. No. And this is that's the ultimate example.
Right.
And Brooks's columns are hilarious because they are always sort of like transparently literary. Like, he's always trying to do something that like we all learned in high school and like we should have left in high school.
Yeah.
Right.
You like Cap, showing not telling.
Yeah.
Union busting.
Exactly. He does this whole column. He talks about the idea is the ordinary Twitter person is like socially isolated and is lashing out because of things that have happened in his life.
Yeah.
So he writes, adults in my life have not been trustworthy. Friends have not been trustworthy. Women reject me. I pass through school unseen. You have no idea how ill-equipped I am to deal with my pain. I was raised in that coddling way that protects you from every risk except real life. It's clearly he's kind of talking about himself
a little bit, right?
Yeah,
a lot of projection, but, yeah. Just has projecting. Just has a well-paying job.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing about this is like, if you work in the media, everybody gets abused on social media.
Right. I mean,
this is part of the job now. Like, you have to get, and a lot of it is organized. There are paid trolls in there who are trying to wind you up, who are trying to spread rumors about you and lies about you. This is part of the business now. But the fact that they keep going, that they actually think that this is like a real huge, gigantic international political problem.
Right.
That like people, you know, say mean things about David Brooks and Brett Stevens on Twitter. I mean, they say mean things about all of us. But
yeah.
That's like, you know, it's not a thing. You know?
They try to use civility instead of I mean, their entire political horizon is how they're treated online.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's how out of touch they are.
Yeah. I hate to go back to this, but Brooks, this whole style, it reminds me of, you ever see the movie Love and Death, the Woody Allen movie?
Yes.
There's a scene where Woody is now like a retired lord in Russia, and he's living on his estate, and he's trying to think of something to do with his life, and he decides to try out poetry. So he starts scribbling, I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across silent seas. Then he goes, nah, too sentimental, and he like crosses it out and throws it away. Like, that's what a normal rational person does when you catch yourself being pretentious and literary.
You just throw it out,
like, forget it. This is what doesn't happen to you when you've been in the New York Times op-ed page for too long. You start to think that like everything you write actually is, you know, really, really good.
Instead of throwing it out, you throw it to your editor at the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly. This is the second example of, you know, the Brett Stevens editor should have sort of laid down the law. Look, dude, I think you should leave the bed bug thing alone.
Right.
And
or his wife.
Or his wife, yeah, exactly. This is another example where, you know, you submit a column and you would hope that your editor in that case says, you know, I don't think you should do Diary of a Madman, you know, as a Twitter hater. Try something else, you know?
Right.
But they just kind of zoom it through.
I mean, this isn't limited to the Times, but that is where I feel like they've really perfected it.
Right,
that's where
yeah.
it's like a really an art. In fact, David Brooks should stick to that. Just like if we see Brooks as art and his output as unintentional art, then it's good.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And has Friedman done one?
I don't know. Has he? Friedman, who starts all of his columns with "so." I was in a cab. That's actually
I've never noticed that.
Yeah,
that's great.
I got to credit Ben Norton. He's the one who said that to me on my show once.
All right. So we're going to be talking in a little bit to Will Menaker from Chapo Trap House. We're both very familiar with. We go back. We have both have background with that excellent podcast. One of the themes that we're going to talk about, and it's apropos to his career and the whole rise of Chapo and everything, is the whole idea that there's a schism within the Democratic Party. And this is sort of still being litigated 4 years later. And there was a little bit of news on this front because a story appeared in Politico basically saying that Hillary and Elizabeth Warren have been in contact with each other. No, in itself, it's not much of a story, but there have been some whispers on that front throughout, this idea that where is the Clinton wing of the party going to throw their weight in the next year or so? And really, it's obviously not going to be Biden for obvious reasons. So
yeah.
It's beginning to look like that's where that whole crew is going to end up. You know, backing, which is interesting because they weren't at the beginning of the race, right?
They were, I think, pretty Harrisonian.
Kamalian,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And then there was money that poured into Buttigieg, but his campaign didn't work out. So it looks like this is where the dynamic is going to go. I mean, or at least that's a question that's starting to be asked now is that where this group is going to be?
Yeah. And that, of course, people don't know Chapo is like, what, one of the most successful podcast on the left.
What's interesting about Chapo is they started off, basically they were just a bunch of comedians and
Twitter people
who started riffing on politics in an interesting, funny way, and who didn't kind of fit into the normal conception of what a politics show was about, because their opinions were a little bit off kilter. They didn't kind of fit into the MSNBC framework,
right?
And among other things, because of that, they became vilified towards the end of the 2016 political cycle, because to sort of regular Democrats, they represented something that was negative, this sort of rise of the quote-unquote dirtbag left. And I think at the time, people thought this was going to be a temporary phenomenon, but 4 years later, it clearly isn't. And I think that's part of what people like Brooks are reacting to, is this idea that people...
Yeah, like the democratization of a certain level of media, or giving voice to certain people, or the fact that they're so popular.
Right.
And of course, one of the things that the people have done to like silence them has been using this Bernie Bros narrative, which we'll have to talk about in another episode. But just like they talk about being rude online, like with David Brooks. And it's not even true anymore. The narrative we now know, it's not even true demographically. But that's something that, people don't really want to respond to their politics. So they just say that they're misogynist bros.
And another thing that drives me crazy, almost every story about Chapo points out that they make money.
Oh, yeah. Right? Patreon. I get this, too, by the way, because I have my podcast as Patreon. It's all about being on Patreon. You're dissed for being on Patreon, as if they were not hiding it.
Right. Yeah. And then, they always say they make so much money per podcast. Do we
it's not
ever
like blood money?
Yeah, did we talk about how much
David Brooks makes?
Yeah, or any columnist, they make real money. They make a lot of money,
and so
do we have somebody else who makes money that's like bad? I don't understand that.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess you could theoretically say, okay, they're socialists, so that's a thing.
Right, but we still live in the capitalist world system.
Yeah,
so,
that's a topic for another time. But they've always said that about Chapo, and that drives me nuts when people do that.
Yeah.
Like it's a bad thing. It's a good thing. The landscape should be a little bit more diverse.
So without any further ado, let's bring on Will.
Sounds good. All right, welcome back to Useful Idiots, and we are joined by
Will Menaker.
Hello.
Chapo Trap House.
Joy to be here. How are you guys doing?
Good, yeah.
Great. So we both have kind of a unique connection to Chapo, right?
Well, full disclosure, I feel like I have to be transparent about
this. Yeah, go for it.
You and I are something cousins. My cousin is married to your cousin.
I don't technically, it makes us kin.
Kin. We're kinfolk.
That's what it means.
Definitely kin. Yeah.
Our cousins are married to each other.
Right, our cousins are married to each other.
Yeah.
You did not attend the wedding.
I was in, I think, Chicago at the time doing the show.
Yeah, so. I held it down for both of us. You were mentioned, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I told my uncle mentioned you because he was talking about like the connections between the families and
all the people that were too big to be here.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. He cursed you.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it was nice.
You also hosted the first ever Chapo live show. That was the first time me, Matt, and Felix were ever in the same room together at the same time.
Wait, is that a moment?
How did that work? You'd never met before?
Oh, we had met each other individually, every combination, but we had all three of us had never been in the same room before.
Wow.
It was unclear if they all existed.
Yeah.
But yeah, because Matt lived in
Cincinnati at the time. Then. And Felix had just moved to the city.
Yeah.
So how are you doing this? Were you doing the show?
Originally we would just all talk over like a Google Hangout and record our own audio tracks and then just like stitch them together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It took a while before we were like all just, you know, in the same room recording on studio mics and things like that.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was really
cool. That was one of your first guests too, right?
Yes, you were. Matt, you were our first like big get, you know. I was super nervous about that one. And then like
no, you're not.
While doing the interview, like my Google Hangout just like cut out. And like I was like out of that interview for like 2 minutes, scrambling to get back on, but I seamlessly played it off. Like,
wow, I didn't notice. Yeah.
No, the Taibia made us. It was like Lufthansa heist.
Hey, Jimmy! That's great.
Or Air France, I should say.
Yeah, the Air France. We are the security. You're looking at
it. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So that was 4 years ago. That was at the beginning of the...
Yeah, it was three or four years ago.
Because I remember that was right in the... Well, it was in 2016, it was, right?
We started going, like, I think April 2016. And I guess, like, you know, we sort of took off, like, as the Democratic, you know, primary was in 2014. I mean, 2016, rather. And here we are again.
Right.
Coming up on 2020. Basically... Same shit going on.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I don't want to be repetitive or whatever. But,
I know. They're always like, don't relitigate the primary. It's like, well, the lessons haven't really been learned by a lot of people, so we have to.
There's been no verdict rendered. The case is just ongoing.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is still a thing, right? The big Democratic schism. I mean, Chapo was one of the first shows that really kind of put a face on the whole idea that there were two different wings of the Democratic Party. Yeah.
I mean, I think it was, Vince Lombardi said luck is the residue of skill. I think, you know, it's just luck is the residue of being in the right place at the right time. And when we started doing it, it didn't seem like we were, you know, staking out some, you know, hugely needed position. Right. It just seemed like this is what we believed. You know, like the idea that Hillary Clinton and the Democrats are like, you know, sort of risible figures didn't seem like, you know,
a huge lift or anything controversial.
Right. But lo and behold, we found out, like not only was there like a big audience for that, particularly among people who are into comedy and politics and looking for, you know, I guess it's broadly political satire or whatever that.
Right.
And but like also not from like a bogus sort of both sides are wacky.
Yeah.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the
right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Right,
like that kind of thing that had like kind of a strong point of view. But I mean, like I guess the schism in the Democratic Party is still there. But if you look at the platforms of all of the 2020 Democratic candidates. I mean, I guess it's progress that it's like vastly more to the left than Hillary Clinton ran in 2016.
Sure.
And I think that's all due to Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
I mean, whether
they're good for any of it is another
open question.
Right.
But
I mean, I find that really amazing. The platform has moved so dramatically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you go out in the, you know, I mean, you were in Iowa, right?
You
listen to all the candidates. They're basically all, I mean, they sound like Bernie in 2015, 2016, almost everything they're saying, but
without the accent.
With the exception of like John Delaney and like Michael Bennett
and
like Hinkenlooper, and I think half of them have already dropped out. But
right.
Like, you know, like the top tier, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, even, you know, Joe Biden has to try to affect something that is like a simulacra of a kind of populist platform.
Right, yeah, even his launch speech was all about, you know, taking on rejecting the corporate donors or something like that. That was part of his thing, but
That's why his eye was leaking blood, because
he was straining
so hard.
Right. I mean,
someone's got to stop this. Like,
he's Godzilla.
Joe Biden, like, it's not funny anymore. Like, it's the people around him who are making him do this. He confused Angela Merkel with Margaret Thatcher the other day.
I saw you tweeting about that. That's not easy.
And, you know, I mean, I know it's like an easy thing to do, but it really does reveal like the contours of like how our politics is policed by the media. Could you imagine if Bernie Sanders was struggling to complete a sentence regularly and then like making those kinds of gaffes that are just like your brain fitting out, or you just Joe Biden starts a sentence and then like he's going and then 30 seconds into it he'll just like
yield his
wheels
time.
Will spin out totally.
It's amazing.
And then his eye starts bleeding live on national television. This would be the like Bernie Sanders would be the end of his campaign.
Absolutely.
Overnight without question.
Yeah. I mean, he'd be forced into a retirement home.
And the funny thing
not allowed to run.
The eye bleeding thing is when that happened I was like it was just like of a random evening, me and my girlfriend were just watching a movie. You know, I spent 2 hours without looking at my phone, you know, pat myself on the back there. And then I, you know, it's over. I look at my phone and I'm like, this is a Photoshop, right? Joe Biden's eye didn't start bleeding on television, right? And then I start looking around to confirm that it's not just some windup. And like the only people who were covering it at the time were the right-wing media.
Right.
It was only the Daily Caller and like DC Examiner and Washington Times and like those types of outlets. And I swear to God, I spent the whole next day looking at the New York Times and the Washington Post for any mention of that in the climate forum. And none of them talked about it.
It's
bizarre.
It's like the Soviet Union in 1928, right? Like Trotsky has been carefully etched out of it.
Yeah, exactly. They cropped some... copied and pasted something over it.
Yeah.
A white thing.
You were comparing him to Vincent the Chin Gigante, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's crazy like a fox.
Right.
He's lulling everyone into a false sense of security so that when, you know, when this Thursday debate, he's bringing out the real Biden.
Yeah,
he's going to come with zingers.
The zingers, right.
He's going to be sharp. He's going to be articulate. He's going to be clear-headed.
Until then, he's going to walk around in a bathrobe.
In a bathrobe, peeing in his neighbor's lawn. Not shaving.
So funny. He's actually hilarious. We should do a mashup of all his gaffes, but I mean, who was
it
saying?
The whole show, though. That's
I know
the
you're right. We don't have the time, but you know, this is a like a gem that hasn't really been exposed a lot. But he did mention Shylocks. Do you remember that,
Joe Biden?
Yeah,
no,
he's like a bunch of Shylocks. Yeah, he was talking about like predatory lenders or something. Yeah, which I just feel like that was an unsung, underexposed moment.
Okay.
And we should definitely put that in.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what context you use the word shy. Like, unless you're saying, oh, in high school,
in
I studied
Merchant of Venice.
Right. You said that. I was just imagining Trump talking about, folks, I have very good relations with merchants.
Yeah, exactly.
You're wonderful. You got an excellent deal, a pound of flesh.
Well, we did. Last time we played, a couple episodes ago, we played audio of him, like, riffing at the Republican-Jewish coalition. And he's like, they're a bunch of, are you guys good negotiators? I'm a good negotiator. I've never been in a room with such good negotiators. I think they're a couple of negotiators here, am I right? It was hilarious. Funny because it's true.
Absolutely.
And also, you were talking about the niche that you guys fill. And another thing is, of course, that you're irreverent and funny, but from the left. So there's a lot of that from the right. It's not funny, but they pretend to be.
I think it's just it's part of like they all give themselves the same jobs. And they, like if you're one of the 20 weirdos on your campus of 50,000 like wearing a bow tie and is like sincerely committed to conservative politics at 18 or 19 like there will not just be a job for you at some think tank or some David Koch RIP funded outlet. You will also get the added benefit of everyone agreeing that you're actually very edgy and dangerous and funny.
Right. It's just mean-spirited, basically, is what
Not even that. Like,
you don't think they can reach that?
Well, of course they're mean-spirited just like by nature of their souls. But
right.
Like, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with being mean-spirited.
Against the right people.
Well, I mean, just in general.
The bad people.
No, it's just like anything that like so loudly announces that like I'm edgy and dangerous is just like the most bland, anodyne garbage imaginable.
But as you've said, and I mean, this is a big debate, you know, this does fill, there are people who are disaffected looking for something irreverent, entertaining, and this fills that from the left as opposed to from the right. Whether or not, like without having a referendum on the humor, it's still,
well, also
I think
the,
there are
the
people up for grabs.
The
who
Clintonian
you guys get,
Democrats are deeply unfunny, aren't they?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. They don't get enough stick for being like as brutally unfunny as like, you know, I don't know, like the Daily Wire crowd.
Right.
Or like, you know, right wing.
Except for Hillary's joke about
comedians.
Pokemon go out to the polls.
That was
and
funny.
Vote.
That was
great. Yeah, that was a great moment.
Then you called George Will like a he was like a standard bow tie dipshit or something
like that.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
They've mutated into like other forms.
Right. Right.
Isn't he part of the resistance with Jennifer Rubin?
The Pokemon have evolved. They've all leveled up in various ways since the 2016 election. Oh, like John Bolton?
I know.
John Bolton just got fired today. He's going to be a member in good standing.
Yeah,
in like a
the
week.
Resistance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
he's going to be rehabbed. He's going to be on MSNBC
and the Washington Post, maybe
saying, "How dare you, sir?" Yeah.
Right. He's going to have his own panel show. Yeah. Like, yeah. Right. Before, in between Rachel and Lawrence O'Donnell.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
He's
what would it be called? What would the Bolton show?
The Walrus Factor. Doesn't he look like a walrus? I don't mean to be.
Or
the
how about just
somewhere.
I am the walrus?
I'm the walrus. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I'm the walrus.
Yeah.
No, but you know, just like decent. Sane conservatives like John Bolton, you know, I think we need to side with him against this dangerous, unhinged president that we have.
Right, Who looks like a peacenik next to John Bolton, right? He really does. He's like the peaceful wing of the totally bellicose, belligerent, hawkish.
Well, there's some kind of celebrity math thing going on with him, Kurt Vonnegut, and Twain, I think.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I can't figure it's like a times 0.3 or something like that, like mustache.
Right, yeah. Back to the stash issue, yeah.
Yeah.
But remember, there's a story about him banging really hard on someone's hotel door in the middle of the night?
When a federal contractor criticized a deal Bolton was working on, she said Bolton threw a tape dispenser at her, shouted threats, chased her down a Moscow hotel hallway, pounded on her door, and generally behaved like a madman, which is easily the second worst thing a member of this administration has done in a Russian hotel.
Imagine looking in that key.
I know, and just seeing the bristle, the tusk or whatever.
So how do you think this is going to play out with the Democrats? I mean, one of the things I like about what you've been saying all along throughout this entire campaign cycle, because I thought the same thing early on, was that in the end, this is ultimately going to be kind of about Bernie versus Warren, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, initially the kind of conventional wisdom take on this election is, oh, Warren and Bernie are competing for this one sort of narrow slice of the electorate that is, you know, roughly speaking, the Bernie wing from last time. And then there's going to be this big fight for the establishment lane between Harris and Biden. But I don't think it's going to play out that way. Do you? I think it's going to end up with...
No, I think it's probably going to be... I think Warren and Bernie are the ones that are going to go the distance. Like, I think Joe Biden, for obvious reasons, it's very hard for me to imagine that he's going to be the nominee.
Right.
Very hard for me to imagine. And if the Democrats do that, it will be a disaster.
Yeah. Right.
It will be a disaster.
It'll only be funny for the first couple of minutes. And then
I'm torn about that.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not making like confident. I think basically any Democrat could beat Trump and any Democrat could lose to him.
It all
depends on who they nominate and how they run a campaign. But I think what we're seeing now is Biden, I think a lot of people are beginning to hedge on him because he's, you know, going a bit doolally in the brain. And I think Kamala is kind of a choker. Like, I mean, look at Kamala's entire staff were just all the losers from the Clinton campaign. So like that, if that's evidence of, I mean, I it's hard for me to imagine that she's going to, but I think Warren is for real.
Right.
And I think she's going to go the distance. I really think it is going to be Warren against Bernie. And I think that the money and the sort of the party grandees are going to begin to coalesce around Warren as the more palatable option.
Right. And you tweeted about this as well, too, because there have been kind of signs all the way through that that was going to happen. Remember there was that piece in Politico a while ago where they quoted one of Joe Lieberman's speechwriters. There was a whole thing about how Warren was emerging as the compromise choice.
Yeah.
And you keep doing this. You keep talking about how this is another endorsement for Bernie every time.
Exactly.
Yeah. He has that listicle of people who evil people have endorsed him. By the way, I have to announce this because it's very important. Historically speaking, I met him. I finally met him. Got my photo taken with him.
Who?
Bernie.
With Daddy.
Bernie. Oh yeah.
With Daddy. Yeah. Uncle Bernie. Amo Bernie, as the Arab speaking people call him. That sounds like
I've never met him, but I stood very close to him in Iowa.
Yeah.
At the press scrum.
It was actually the second time I met him, but the first time I was like a drive by, like I kind of ambushed him because I was at the Sanders Institute and Cenk Uygur was interviewing him, and I happened to have my microphones out because I was unsuccessfully trying to interview Haddad, the Brazilian, you know, the man who lost to Bolsonaro.
Mm-hmm.
And so right after, I was like doing the audio for them. And then right after that, I asked him a question and he was like really busy and, you know, his crotchety menschy way that he is. And this time I was at this event in Brooklyn and we all got on the selfie line. And I went up to him and I said, I write about you for FAIR. And then they took the photos, right? And then he goes, so you write for FAIR? And I was like, yeah, yeah, I wrote about Sydney Ember and I wrote this piece about MSNBC. He's like, I saw it, thank you. And I was like, because with other politicians, they would just say that even if they hadn't seen it, but Sanders wouldn't. That's one of his like things, you know, if he hadn't read it, he'd be like,
yeah, or they'd be like, you're like, I write for FAIR, and they'd be like, yes, yeah, journalism should be
yes,
FAIR.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah.
Support,
yeah.
Right, right, supports right. Fairness.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's like fairness, I think you yeah, mean, yeah. Ms. Yeah, ma'am. Yeah, so anyway, that was great.
That's great, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So,
good photo, too, thank God. Imagine if it had been a bad photo, I would have been so torn. That's what when you're a woman, I'm generalizing, but that's a thing. It's like even when you're a feminist, the content is one thing and the form is another. In a way, it isn't for men. So honestly, if it had been an unflattering photo, I'm not sure I would have shared it.
No, I sympathize with that because like some of our earliest like press photos we did as a joke and I had like contouring makeup on. And we all looked like purposely stupid, but like that's the photo that is most commonly shared, yeah. And it kind of annoys me because
right.
I'm like, yeah. No,
whereas I want the contour, yeah, yeah, yeah. Switch, yeah. Who's your makeup artist?
Yeah. But yeah, like to your point about Sanders and Warren, this idea that they're both competing for like a big chunk of the you know progressive wing of the party. I think what we're seeing is like as it plays out, like their bases or their voters are actually very different groups
totally.
Of people.
Absolutely.
And that like, you know, Elizabeth Warren's voters are the more highly educated, sort of professional.
Whiter.
Whiter and sort of like, I think they represent a more meritocratic
right. That's
part
exactly
of
it.
American society. These are the people who, this is like what is so, When the thing like that people talk about, like what they love so much about Warren, they always like her plans, right. Like this is her big thing.
Yeah.
Her plans. She's got a plan. Not only does she have a plan, she has a plan for how to pay for it. And it's just like it,
except
okay.
for healthcare, which she somehow doesn't have. Plan
that's
for.
Interesting. And I think that speaks to like her appeal among the type of people who really have done the homework, you
right.
know, and succeeded and like, you know, have played, you know, played by the rules the right way. And when you hear Warren's, you know, stump speech, or like, you know, when I saw her in Iowa or you see her pitch, it's about like, you know, look, the system isn't working for,
right.
It's only working for a small amount of people. And like the rest of us, like, you know, we're not getting a fair deal. And it's about like, she has the plans and like, we want to make the system work for like the people who have studied and like worked hard.
Right.
And it's about this, like, it's sort of a consumer model of capitalism. Like
right.
it's like your cable company's ripping you off. Like this is outrageous. They need
right.
to be brought to account.
Yeah.
You know? And like, and I think Bernie speaks to this, like a way more class-based ideal of politics, where it's just like these things like healthcare and housing and education should not be for people who are like only for like the smart people.
Right. Right.
Or like the people who work hard or
yep.
whatever. It should just be like a baseline.
Yeah.
expectation for everyone who's drawing a breath within the United States.
Right.
And like I think he has a vision of capitalism that is more antagonistic because he understands this is about class power. And it's not about like capitalism isn't, you know, working for the middle class or whatever
yeah.
the way it should be. And I think Warren is sincere like in her beliefs, and I think a lot of, you know, her plans if they were implemented would be good and would ameliorate a lot of the, you know, misery in this country that would certainly work towards that end. But I think there is a marked difference in not just the policies themselves, but like the overall political vision and just sort of how they the two of them see politics. And I think that is borne out in if you look at the people who are voting for them, who are their voters.
Right.
And Bernie Sanders has a much more diverse, younger and lower income voting base.
Yeah. I want to go back to that serious discussion that we're having because I think this is actually extremely important. And it's something that I think the Bernie left hasn't done a great job of articulating. And I say that as, you know, part of the Bernie left, obviously. So it's not throwing shade. I just think that we do need to figure out how to talk about it because I think the way we talk about it is very, like, if you understand politics or political theory or you're excited about that or about class politics, you get it. But it is hard sometimes to explain it to people because I know like in 2016 people would say, oh, it's for, you know, we need a woman. Be like, yeah, I would love a woman with Sanders politics. But there's such a difference between the two of them, you know, Fight for 15, war, which are feminist issues, by the way. But there's such a difference that that's kind of a ridiculous demand to make. Here, it's a little bit harder because it is almost like political theory, right? It's about their conceptions of power, their record, sure, the consistency thing. But to be honest, I don't think that's the most convincing one because I think it's good to evolve. But I have struggled with that. And I think it's one of those things that, like, if you follow politics and you have a certain conception of it, it's very obvious. But I don't know how to translate it to people who don't.
I mean, okay, well, then leaving aside their differing bases and political visions, like, as someone who's, look, I'm not objective. Like, I want Sanders to win this primary.
Right.
I think he should be and will be our next president.
Also more electable.
Yeah.
Well,
that,
Trump,
okay, exactly.
Yeah,
totally, I would just say, I would make the electability argument.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You've been making that
I think
all
Elizabeth
along,
Warren is a huge liability for us in the general election. And, like,
I actually agree.
You know, like, and it's hard to say that without being like, oh, you're being
you're
so mean to Elizabeth Warren or a misogynist or whatever. But I'm sorry, like, I just do not think she has the appeal to the type of voters that the Democrats need to turn out and win in a general election. And I think, like, the same thing that is so appealing to her supporters, this I'm always prepared, I did the homework kind of thing, I really don't think that's an appealing message to most Americans. Again, the idea of, like, most people who aren't haven't climbed the meritocratic ladder in this country and who experience this country and daily life in a much different way than, like the sort of professional liberal class does.
Yeah, I mean, a friend of mine, we talked about this in the show already, that a friend of mine who sort of works in politics is talking about how Elizabeth Warren is identity politics for journalists. Because, you know, the reason that people who do this job like her, you know, she's me. She's a smart aleck from Massachusetts, basically, you know, and her pitch is very, like, intellectual, university-educated.
Policy-based,
she sort of radiates
wonky.
This whole idea of, like, wonkiness, smartness. Whereas, you know, Bernie, I think when you go to his crowds, you know, whether you like his policies or not, they pick up on the fact that this is somebody who kind of came from mean circumstances, who's not quite, you know, like a Princeton ivory tower kind of person. I think that has a lot to do with it, too, don't you think? I mean, there's that whole, if they get to a general, some of that is going to come into play.
Also, you know, when I was in Iowa and I saw the whole parade of all these candidates coming through and giving their stump speech and then talking to the press, the thing you notice about Bernie, and this is the first time I'd seen him in person, is that when he does his pitch or when he talks to a crowd or even when he answers questions from the media, he's the only one of these people running for the Democratic nomination that can express anger at the current, at the state of this country or the people running it and anything, and not only express anger, but do it in a convincing way.
Right.
And, like, I think that is hugely, I'm sorry, like, that's why I like him.
Right.
I think that's why his message resonates to a large degree, because you should be pissed off.
Right.
And you should not just be pissed off, like, vaguely at, like, oh, those clowns in Congress. But, like, you should be pissed off at, like, very specific people. And, like, you need to realize that all these things that you want, all these plans, whether they're Warren's or Sanders or any Democratic nominee, they're not going to be worth anything, or they're not going to go anywhere until you identify the people, not just, like, the reasons, but the people who are standing who are opposed to it.
Yeah,
who
you have to vilify
make
the
it
people.
So that it's impossible to have decent health insurance in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, it's the health insurance industry. And Sanders is largely the only one who really expresses that.
And then he gets that really annoying criticism of, well, you're just like Trump because you're angry. It's like,
he's angry at the media.
That's why you win. Like, that makes him competitive against Trump.
That's what's always bizarre to me whenever that argument gets made, like the comparisons of Sanders to Trump and, like, all these things that he spoke, like, you know, he singles out the media as well.
Which we talked
or, you know,
about. So
during one of the debates, Jake Tapper asked Sanders, like, you know, you said America can't be the world's policeman, and Donald Trump has said that, like, you know, how are voters supposed to tell the difference between you two? And it's like, all these things are, it's just like, we can't be like Trump. This is like Trump. I'm just like, you know, he's president, right?
Right, yeah.
You know, he won the last election.
Right.
Like, we can't emulate in any way, even superficially, the guy who won. And if you look at these Democrats, they're all gearing up to run the Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like, it may work for them, because Trump is, like, you know, pretty unpopular, and maybe the economy will take a turn or whatever. But they are all gearing up, like, all of them, other than Sanders, are going to try to run Hillary's campaign in 2016, the general.
Yeah, the essence of it is, you know, we're technocrats, which is, like, a sort of a word that, you know, people in the media class, they love that concept of, like, the sort of impartial, apolitical administrator who over a course of a long career has competence in sort of fixing things without having like really wacky political ideas. And so, but by nature, that's sort of an insider's view of things, mm-hmm. right? Because they've been on the inside. The whole argument is we've been on the inside for so long, we know how to do this.
Right.
Whereas mm-hmm.
they don't get a sense of how it's not working for other people.
Right. And Trump openly ran as an outsider. That was the biggest thing that, that worked for him. And you know, I think Sanders does that on the Democratic side. Some of the others do too. I mean, Yang, you know, does that. I mean, but among the top tier candidates, right? I mean, it feels like none of the others are really believable.
Yes. And also the anger is something that, like, it's so different when you're angry and you're blaming, like, the healthcare industry versus blaming Muslims and Mexicans. Like, that's how you reach the people who feel upset. I actually see a parallel between Sanders and Trump and Chapo and alt-right. I know it may sound weird. No, but that's good. Sanders obviously is good. But, like, there are people up for grabs. And there's this narrative that Sanders' his appeal to for people up to grabs somehow throws other people under the bus, which it doesn't. Like, he doesn't have one single policy that is bad for people of color, LGBTQ people, and women. This whole narrative of, like, the white working class standing in opposition to other working class populations, that is something, maybe it's just on Twitter, but it's pretty...
I mean, it's on MSNBC, too. There's, like, a very conscious effort to, whenever Bernie Sanders talks about, like, the working class in this country, to sort of, like, pretend like he's subliminally adding the word white on there, or even worse, that he's talking about Trump voters.
Because,
like, the average Republican voter or Trump supporter in this country is not working class.
Right.
Read that article that BuzzFeed just did this past weekend about the bikers for Trump rally. These are all, like, rich retirees who have Harleys as a hobby. These people have employees. They own property. These are not people who are white-knuckling it to a large degree.
White-knuckling it? Really? Really, Will?
Wake me up!
Can I just add one other difference between Bernie and Hillary? I mean, Bernie and Warren.
Wake me
so
up!
Another thing is that Bernie did not contribute to a cookbook. Do you know about this?
No.
A cookbook called Pow Wow Chow.
Ooh.
I'm not kidding.
Come on, this is an onion
story. It's not. Nope. It's called Pat. And I'm not a Warren hater. I prefer Bernie, right? I get frustrated with the way that they're seen as the same, because there are important differences from electability to the way they see power to, you know, lots of things. But Elizabeth Warren's Pow Wow Chow Cherokee recipes were, so not only did she contribute to a cookbook called Pow Wow Chow, she contributed Cherokee recipes, and they were apparently word-for-word copies of famous French chefs' techniques.
So plagiarism, that goes against... The meritocrats hate that.
Yeah.
It's copying someone else's homework.
It's exactly.
Yeah.
Very simple.
Very Jeff Sokoli.
The image of it is just amazing.
No, but I'm sorry.
It's from 1984.
Her DNA test thing is also very telling, because, one, it's absolutely not going to go away.
Yes,
and it's a huge liability, and it also shows you she did that because Donald Trump got under her skin.
Exactly,
right. And it was like, it was such a dumb move.
Yeah,
right.
And she did it, and it's going to haunt her. And then, like, I think there's a Harvard Law Review article that promotes her as, like, one of their first, like, minority women professors or whatever.
Right.
There's a lot of that stuff out there that is deeply embarrassing, and like, and I'm sorry, makes her look terrible, and like it. I'm saying she's a liability in the general election. I would vote for her in New York State if she is the nominee. But I'm saying right now, the best possible thing Elizabeth Warren could do was have run in 2016,
which
Sanders wanted her to do, and she could have beaten Hillary Clinton in that election.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the most positive thing she should do now, if she stands for and supports the things that her plans, is drop out, endorse Bernie.
I agree. Yeah,
I'm sorry to say it, but if you care about the future of the country, Elizabeth,
totally agree.
That's the most positive thing
Liz,
you can do.
Liz, we're talking to you. We like you, but we have
suggestion. I mean, I know, like, for me, that's like just poison. But
I know. I'll say it.
I'll say it.
I mean, if she's contributing to, you know, her thoughts on Cherokee cuisine, like, this is like high school. Like, you can't, you know, when somebody comes up to you and gives you a hard time, you can't keep doubling down on the response to it. She's got to figure out another way to deal with it. And if that's going to be her response to Trump, I'll get a DNA test. Like, that's just not going to work.
I do think it's useful to have her in for a little bit more to kind of help shift things to the left, even if it's just rhetorically. And I don't think she's like Harris or Biden. I think that she's not as left as Sanders, but I think maybe it helps just in terms of optics and the Overton window.
Mm-hmm.
But then she'll have to pretty soon.
Well, she's not. She's not going to because she is polling very well, and she has a very, very well-run, smart campaign.
Well.
Like
very
they're,
well.
They're, they, she has very, very good professionals working for. A lot of them come from Harry Reid's staff.
Right.
These
so
are
exciting.
Like you know these people are not. They're no dummies. This isn't like the Harris Biden staff.
Right.
These people are smart.
Right.
They know what they're doing, and they're.
Bernie
well,
has some Reid people in it.
Bernie has some Reid people
Faz,
as well.
Faz,
yeah.
Faz, right. Faz Shakir.
So it's my dream scenario is unlikely to happen, and here's the thing though. Warren would not be polling this well if Sanders wasn't in the race. They would all be ganging up on
right.
her. Like the media would be talking about her, how irresponsible and dangerous all of her
well,
ideas
they
and plans are.
She
yeah, they did.
In.
And
yeah.
powwow
like,
chow.
Like and powwow chow and all that. Like and she is the beneficiary of a very concerted effort to
yeah.
nullify Sanders
right.
and defang any kind of nascent left wing populism in the Democratic Party.
Right.
Well, third way. Remember, they said that she was like they urged people not to follow her and De Blasio off the cliff. Populist
right.
cliff. They said that in what 2016, and now
yeah,
they would
then,
endorse anyone except for Sanders.
I'm getting
yeah,
a very
they had Matt Bennett, right? The co-founder
yeah,
was,
yeah.
was
right.
The
right.
It was talking about how yeah, she was a compromise.
I'm just
candidate.
I'm you know I'm doing the Karnak. I have the envelope to my head, and I just have I have a vision of Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg
oh,
as,
no.
as a ticket. I mean,
that
I'm not trying
so
to will
scary.
It happen.
That's
Bernie
so
Sanders
triggering.
Will be the nominee. He will be our next president.
Just really, really quickly, there's been a whole succession of these articles from New York Times op-ed writers, and they're all kind of complaining that people who aren't big-time op-ed columnists or random people on Twitter or whatever, the core complaint seems to be that other people besides us get to have opinions
say,
now.
Yeah.
I feel like they're kind of partly talking about people like you when not, they're talking ostensibly about people on Twitter, but I think what they're really resenting is that there are these other voices that are
right.
rising up from the internet that get more traction than they are.
Yeah.
I mean, do you get
it? Oh, yeah. I mean, I even said it about the David Brooks piece.
Oh, did you?
I was like, I am the sick and spiteful young man that I'm writing about, except the difference is instead of miserable obscurity, I'm getting paid.
Uh-huh. Right, yeah, yeah, yeah,
get
yeah,
rich,
exactly,
motherfucker.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, like all these people like Barry Weiss or whatever who have, you know, David Brooks. I mean, I'm talking about the younger generation
right.
Opinion people who have, I'm sorry, kissed the asses of like the most evil people alive to get their little share of the discourse or whatever.
Right.
And then lo and behold, it finds out that like you can also have a very successful career just calling them an asshole on Twitter because like that's how popular it is to just defame and mock these
yeah.
people.
Right.
That's how much
that's
it
like,
resonates.
That's how little people take you seriously because like, you know. Like Barry Weiss or Douthat or whatever, like if they fill a crowd of people for like to talk about one of their books, they're all going to be their parents' age.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like they don't have peers that respect them or like them or just be like, hey, great column. I really liked it.
Right, right, right.
Like they don't get any of that. They get a pat on the head from, you know, the David Koch's ghost or whatever.
Pinch Sulzberger or
yeah,
whatever
exactly.
it is. Yeah,
like,
exactly.
These are real people.
Meanwhile, over here, there are people who are getting paid large amounts of money just to call you an asshole.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but also with David Brooks, you got to understand, and Matt, I know you're a David Brooks scholar. And I think like after reading him and making fun of him for as long as I have, the thing you have to understand is that every David Brooks column is about himself.
Right.
And like people like the new one, like attention haters, like this is I'm going to ventriloquize one of my internet, abusers or whatever. All this stuff about, you know, like feeling rejected and I can't trust adults and what is it to be a man? He's only talking about himself.
Right.
There is no David Brooks column that exists outside of the world of his own sense of sort of shame and embarrassment about his own life.
Right, right. I mean, doesn't it read to you like the love song of J. Alfred David Brooks? Like, I mean, it's totally like I should have been a pair of... I mean, like, it's he's trying to channel some anti-hero literary fantasy.
Yeah,
when he's
yeah.
doing it, it's like really sad. Yeah, but...
Do you want to, before we wrap up really quickly, do you want to read one of your favorite sentences from that?
Just full disclosure, we used to, in my previous podcast, the Tarfu Report, we used to read David Brooks on Helium. but we, you know, Alex and I discovered that you know, wasn't so good for your brain.
Causes brain damage.
Causes brain
yeah.
damage. So it was kind of like, the equation didn't
also,
really
also, the
work.
World is running out of helium.
Right.
So we should be more frugal with how we use this wonderful gas.
That's right. Yeah. So we figured we'd do the 21st century version. We found an app that distorts your voice. So do you want to give a shot at reading the new David Brooks column? And there's a couple of effects here. We got robot. We got guitar. Yeah. Songify.
Organ.
So
yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's give it a shot.
Let's spit.
All right.
When I was younger, my eyes pleaded. tell me what adulthood and manhood are supposed to look like. All you said was, you can be anything you want to be. How does that help? You told me I was special, but the world goes on as if I don't exist.
When I was younger, my eyes pleaded, tell me what adulthood and manhood are supposed to look like.
Oh my
All
God,
you said
amazing.
Was, you can be anything you want to be. How does that help? You told me I was special, but the world goes on as if I don't exist.
We have to do karaoke letters.
Holy
with
shit, that's like
that's
a Devo
amazing.
Song.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
perfect.
Yeah,
that's
exactly,
so good.
Yeah.
I'm really excited.
Freedom
about that.
Of choice. Yeah, that is great.
Freedom
that's
of choice.
Really good.
I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. I am an unattractive man. I believe my liver is diseased.
I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
A-
you want to do one?
Yeah. Okay. I'm one of those fanatics on the alt-right and the alt-left, the ones who make online forums so vicious, the ones who cancel and call out the minority of online posters who fill the air with hate. I'm one of those radicals whose rage is intertwined with psychological fragility, whose anger at real wrongs is corrupted by my existential panic about myself.
Okay. I'm one of those fanatics on the alt-right and the alt-left, the ones who make online forums so vicious, the ones who cancel and call out the minority of online posters who fill the air with hate. I'm one of those
so
radicals
good.
Whose rage is intertwined with psychological fragility, whose anger at real wrongs is corrupted by my existential panic about myself.
That's real. This is going to be so good.
We got to songify it, like
I know.
The Charlie
we
Sheen
have
thing,
to, like,
you know?
Yeah, and we have to do a video with his face, like.
Yeah, with the that would be great. That would be great.
Yeah.
Will, awesome. Thank you so much for coming
you so
in.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having me.
Listen,
you
get the paperback for the book coming out soon,
yeah,
right? So you
got to
plug something.
Paperback for The Chapel Guide to Revolution will be out in October.
Woo.
So be on the lookout for that.
Yep, let us know, and we'll if you have an opening here in
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay, excellent. Thanks so much for coming by.
You can read the whole book with that.
Cheers, guys. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's actually the audio book version.
Yeah,
is all that.
All
thank
right,
you
thank
so
you.
Much. That was great.
It was great. Yeah. Thanks for listening to Useful Idiots.
Yeah, thanks for listening to Useful Idiots, and thank you, Will Menaker, for talking to us. Oh, rate and review us. Rate, review, subscribe,
because
we got to bring down Pod Save America.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Rate and review us because we've... What? Why? Again?
Because we got to... because we need to, among other reasons, we got to beat Pod Save America. That's
right.
Like my big goal in life.
To beat Pod Save America?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Because if not, then you let the Pod Save Americas win.
Right.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.